You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 283, Exodus 17, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how's your summer going?
It's actually gone quickly. I'm just surprised at how fast it's really gone. So yeah. I thought, you know, since I'm working at home, the days would feel longer and the summer would go more slowly, and not so much.
Yeah.
It's just not working out that
way. And you did some traveling in July. I think you recorded some Fringe Pop. Did you do anything else?
Jacksonville. You know, I spoke at the Awakening Conference in Jacksonville. And then, we went out a day early to do the Stranger Things nerdy stuff, then drove down to Jacksonville, spoke there, and then off to Fringe Pop in Dallas.
I think we're far enough removed from the premiere of Stranger Things that we could talk about it. So I did finish the season, so I can get your thoughts. What was your initial thoughts on it?
Oh, I liked the season. I thought it started out a little more slowly than its predecessors, but... You know, after you hit about episode 4, it was just, you know, a mile a minute. So I think it delivered. I was happy with it.
Yeah, I agree with that. It started off slow, but I liked the ending. It was good. I heard season 4 is going to be even stranger. So that's good. Maybe I like the weird.
So. Well, they're out of Hawkins, you know, so that frees them up to do lots of things. So I had to binge watch it. And then Lexham wanted me to add a chapter with my thoughts on the third season. So I did that. And, you know, I didn't want to sort of put out too many theories that I have about season 4, but I hinted a little bit at what I think is going to happen. To me, there was a very distinct pattern through the whole season of season 3 that I think is going to carry into season 4. But, you know, so it was good to add the chapter. You know, it was fun to binge watch it. I mean, my kids were like, I mean, they were through it like 2 or 3 times, you know. But I spot watched, certain scenes after I was through it once, you know, just for the sake of the chapter. So, but it was good. Yeah. It was fun, you know, to visit the places too, you know, where the stuff is filmed, you know, and it's just, you know, they're just there. You know, you just go and, hey, here's this house, here's that house, here's the middle school, you know, get your picture taken there. And, you know, they're all just people's houses or public buildings and that kind of thing. So that was kind of fun.
I'm sure they appreciate all the extra people. I'm sure they appreciate that.
Yeah.
Note to the film people.
Maybe it helps the property value. I don't know.
Just note to Hollywood, don't ever use my house for anything because... I don't need people coming taking pictures, but no, I enjoyed the Hopper character. He was my favorite.
Yeah. I'll go on, right? I don't think he's dead. So don't think there are two possibilities, but again, I didn't want to speculate in the book. It's not that kind of book, but I dropped a few things that, you know, we'll let people know that I have my suspicions. So,
yeah. Well, how in the world does Stranger Things going to tie into Exodus 17, Mike? That's your job for the day.
Well, the monster was really big. You know, that the season 3, I mean, these are all spoilers obviously, but the upside down monster thing was giant, so maybe there's our segue right there, because we're gonna eat some giant cleansed. So
good enough. You
know, it's a bit lame, but it's good enough.
That's all right.
Yeah, the second part here, you know, I telegraphed you kind of what we were going to do here at the end of part 1. And the focus is Exodus 17, 8 through 16. And so we might as well, you know, as we begin, just read those verses again. So this is the Amalek incident. You know, earlier in the chapter, we had the incident at Rephidim, which is, you know, close to Sinai proper. We had the Massah Meribah incident, and we talked about geographically, you know, where these things are, you know, that we have a cluster of terms now by the time we hit Exodus 17. you know, Seir, Edom, Paran, Timon, Rephidim, you know, all these different places. Kadesh was an important one that we talked about last time. That cluster, Midian is the outlier. As we said before, if you go way back, you know, to the episodes we did on Midian and the location of Sinai, the only way you can really factor Midian in is if it's like bordering, you know, this area. But the places that are known here are not in Midian proper. And so that's a big problem for that view of Sinai. But, you know, we talked about the geography last time and where this happens. And basically to make the point, look, if all of these places are sort of associated regionally with Sinai, then you have some cosmic geography going on. And when you have in verse 8, Amalek, it says, came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. You have these people coming into what could very well be, since Rephidim and Massah and Meribah are associated with Kadesh. And again, Kadesh with Paran and Timon and Seir, Edom, Sinai, all that kind of stuff. You could have essentially an infiltration by these outsiders of, you know, what's going to be or what would be conceived of as holy ground, sort of the environs around Sinai, you know, very, very close to it. And, you know, we made the comment, you know, we asked the question, actually, who is Amalek? And Amalek has a history that we will repeat in this episode, just to get us into it, that is associated with all the giant clan stuff. So let's jump in here to verse 8, and I'm just going to read 8 through 16. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Now, you know, what you typically hear with this is that here you have a rogue, you know, people. There's nothing typically unusual about them. They essentially molest Israel on their way to Sinai. I mean, basically, Israel's practically at Sinai, so they're preventing Israel from getting to the mountain of God. And that's so offensive that from here on out, you know, that God is angry at the Amalekites. And that's not untrue, but there's just more lurking in the story than you would suspect. So in the last episode, like I said, we asked, who were the Amalekites? And I'll confess, this episode is going to feel like a long rabbit trail before we return back to the passage and make a few observations. But again, I think it's worth it because this is the kind of thing we do in the Naked Bible that nobody else does, you know, get into some of the weeds here. And there are some really interesting things. So despite the fact that it's going to be, you know, feel like a long rabbit trail, I want to establish that I'm not making up the association of Amalek to terms or people names or labels that are clearly associated with giant clans. I'm not making it up. And you can find these connections in scholarship, and you basically, you know, you find all the data points and then you connect the dots. It's not rocket science in that respect, but you're never going to see these things unless you go looking. So basically, if all you want to know is whether it's reasonable to think that this conflict with Amalek was possibly, at least in part, a conflict with giant clan population, the answer is yes. But explaining why or how that worked in the mind of the biblical writer is, I'll be honest here, that would be a book-length task. So what I'm going to try to do here is summarize a few things in what will feel, again, like a rabbit trail, and then take it back to Exodus 16, 8 through 16, and read that episode supernaturally. or as some would prefer to call it, mythic history. You know, this things that events on the ground that are happening that have a strong, you know, supernaturalistic, divine, in this case, you know, quasi-divine feel to it. So that's what we're going to do in this episode. So we first encounter Amalek, as I mentioned in part one, in Genesis 36:12. That's where we get the name, and I'll just read Genesis 36:11-12. The sons of Eliphaz were Timon, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Verse 12, Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So we learn from that little bit that Timnah is a concubine of Eliphaz, who was Esau's son, whose own mother was Adah, who, if we go back to Genesis 36, verse 2, we find that Adah was the daughter of Elon the Hittite. According to Genesis 36, 20 through 22, a few verses later, Timnah was a Horite, that's H-O-R-I-T-E, one of the native population of Edom. Now, the Horites are going to be our focus today. They were a people group who lived in the hill country of Seir. And Genesis 32, verse 3, tells us that Seir was part of Edom. And according to Deuteronomy 2, verses 10 through 12, verses 20 through 23, we learn that the Horites were defeated and displaced by the Edomites. And they are listed in those passages in Deuteronomy with other people groups that are incontestably giant clans. So this raises the question of, well, who are these Horites exactly? And answering that question requires investigating the contexts in which the Horites are mentioned and doing a little digging into the other people groups with whom they are listed. So again, this is the direction we're going to go, that we have, you know, an association with, again, what is going to emerge as a giant clan population, the Horites. Esau's line has a child by one of these women, and that child is Amalek. And Amalek is the, you know, forefather, the forerunner of the Amalekites. So there's this, you know, line of descent, pardon the pun, that we can look at and say, well, isn't it odd, again, that these are the people that sort of surface when the Israelites are trying to get to Yahweh's domain? And isn't it interesting that Yahweh's domain is sort of smack dab in the middle of this? Because when we have these complex of geographical place names, Seir, Edom, Paran, Timon, Kadesh, Massah, Meribah, Rephidim, okay, all these places, this concatenation of places, we learn from Deuteronomy 2 that earlier than the days of Moses and Joshua, they were just, you know, infested with these giant clans. And the descendants of Esau got rid of most of them. You actually have references to other people, like the Philistines, when they you know, come into the area, they get rid of them, you know, one of the populations as well. I mean, you have the Genesis 14 incident where some of this happens. But it's as though, you know, I'm going to telegraph where we're going here. It's as though God has sort of planted himself in the middle of the chaos tribes, the chaos vestiges of Genesis 6. Because we know that these people groups, we know this again from Deuteronomy 2, both of those passages, that these are the people who are Rephaim, and the Rephaim are Anakim, and the Anakim, by virtue of Numbers 13, 32, and 33, were descended from the Nephilim. Okay, it's as though God just sort of camps right in the middle of this, kind of to make a statement, and then waits there until his own choice of timing to bring his people, Israel, again, the people that he created supernaturally after the Babel incident, to this place. And in, you know, in the centuries prior to that, he is using other lines of Abraham and even other peoples, you know, from you know, other nations, to eliminate these giant clans, sort of to clean house before company gets there, i.e., before the Israelites get there. So again, this is sort of the big picture view of what's going on here in terms of, again, a supernatural outlook of what's going on in these stories. So Deuteronomy 2, let's go back there, 10 through 12, and then 20 through 22. 1923 established the Horites lived in Seir, which is a sub-region of Edom. Rephidim is, of course, again associated with Massah and Meribah, which in other passages, and we mentioned this last time, are explicitly associated with Kadesh. And Kadesh was, of course, the place that Israel failed. Later on, when after Sinai, after they get to Sinai, they get the law, now it's time to go on to the promised land, they're going to come back to Kadesh, and they're going to fail. They're going to send in the 12 spies. 10 of them are going to come back, and they're going to say, forget it. We've looked in there at the land, and we know who's there. We know the Anakim are there. It's worse than we thought. Now, if they're encountering some of these people at the incident at Rephidim, they should have known that God was capable of delivering them. But they fail at the same region, same location, regionally, here at Kadesh. And then that's what initiates the 40 years of wandering. So, we sort of come full circle in a short amount of time, 13 months later, because they're going to be at Sinai for 13 months. So, a little over a year later, they circle back. They're going to go up, through this area. Again, the march from the south, themes that we get in the Hebrew Bible about where Israel comes from to enter the land, or where Yahweh comes from. And here we go. We encounter, some of the same, basically the same situation, probably magnified, more of them. And they just quit. 10 of the spies say, forget it. We can't do it. And then we get 40 years of wandering. So when it comes to the Horites specifically, where we want to camp here, we have limited passages. We have Genesis 36, which we looked at. We've got Deuteronomy 2, 10 through 12, Deuteronomy 2, 20 through 23. And the other passage where they're mentioned is Genesis 14, 5 through 7. So Deuteronomy 2 is where we'll start here. That should be pretty familiar. And I'm going to read the passages in total just so that they're fresh in the minds of the listeners. And then I'm going to make a few observations. So Deuteronomy 2:10 says this: "The Amim formerly lived there, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Amim. The Horites also lived in Seir formerly, but the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave to them." I skip down a little bit, Deuteronomy 2:20. "It is also counted as a land of Rephaim." This is in reference to Ammon now. "Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau who live in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place even to this day. As for the Avim, who lived in villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and settled in their place." That's Deuteronomy 2, 20 and 23, and there's some interesting things. You can already see how what's said about the Amim is almost word for word what's said about the Zamzumim, and again, referencing them as Rephaim and tall like the Anakim. And then that language, some of it, is applied to the Horites. Okay, you just read through the passages and you can notice that. So a couple of observations. Here's what's sort of obvious. The Horites are mentioned in connection with both the Amim, the giant clan of Moab, and the Rephaim Zamzumim giants of Ammon. The Horites are right smack dab in the middle of that. Secondly, Deuteronomy 2 tells us the people of Esau destroyed these giant clans and also destroyed the Horites. Why include the Horites in this description? Unless there was a reason to do so. Third, along with the Amim, Zamzumim, Rephaim, and the Horites, the Avim are mentioned as also being destroyed by the people you know, by people who came in. Interestingly, in this case, it's the Kaftori, okay, people from Kaftor. Now, the Avim were said to have lived in villages as far as Gaza, okay, which is on the coast. That's going to become Philistine territory. So we have another people group of interest here, the Avim, and they live, again, in what would be a traditional Philistine area by the time the Philistines really get some attention in the Hebrew Bible. They are, again, part of this complex. They also show up in Joshua 13, verses 3 through 4. I'll read that. From the Shihor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron, it is counted as Canaanite. There are five rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Avim. In the south, all the land of the Canaanites and Me'arah that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites. Now you get a bunch of people groups in there. We're going to talk about who some of these groups are and their history and how, more importantly, two things. How these people would have been perceived by their contemporaries, by ancient people. And then later on, when we get the Israelites in the picture, how the biblical writers especially would have been using these terms, these people group terms of the population of Canaan. Those are two related but somewhat distinct issues. Now, there's a book I'd recommend if people who are really into this. I recommend this book because it's not easy to find a lot of information about some of these groups because they're basically mentioned once or twice. Avim, you get into the lists of people that are targeted, the Girgashites, the Jebusites, the Perizzites, the Kerethites, all that stuff. There aren't that many good sources, but one of them is by Baruch Margolit. It's called The Sea Peoples in the Bible. The Sea Peoples, for those who aren't familiar with the term, they were people from the Aegean who come from that area, crossed the relevant portions of the Mediterranean, and they settle in Canaan eventually. You get them in Canaan in Syria. They try to attack Egypt. This is where we know the Sea Peoples from, basically Egyptian texts, because the Egyptians had to essentially defeat them and thwart their infiltration. But we don't have an empire in Canaan, so that was just easy pickings for the Sea Peoples to get in there and either decide to live there or move on and invade somebody else. So the Sea Peoples, one of them are the Pelashet, which in biblical language are the Philistines. But some of these other terms that you get with these people groups are derivative from terms, names for the Sea Peoples. So this is a good resource, The Sea Peoples in the Bible by Margolith. That's Margolith. And according to that book, the Avim basically get defeated. The Avim are a people that are there before the Sea Peoples get there. They're defeated by the Philistines, and his take on Joshua 13 is that they essentially, the survivors, the ones that aren't killed, essentially get absorbed into the population of the Philistines. Now, what's also going to happen by the time you get to the days of the conquest is that you're going to have the sons of Anak, the Anakim, those that escape Joshua. They're going to go as well to these places, to the Philistine cities. We know that from Joshua 12, for instance. So, you've got vestiges of the giant clans that are going, these places are going to become known for. Having said that, it seems, and if you do a lengthy study of the Philistines, that you have, since the Philistines are the Sea Peoples and they come from the Aegean, you also have giant traditions, we'll just put it that way, these giant warrior traditions, this sort of sub-population. You have some of that in ancient Greek, again, speaking broadly, material. And some of that gets wrapped up in with the Sea Peoples. And so it's quite possible that you have some of this kind of thing going on with these these people that are unusually tall. And they're perceived, again, as divine offspring and whatnot. especially by the biblical writers, you know, they are agents of chaos because of their history. You know, the Aegean, again, we have to remember this. There's sort of two parts to the Aegean. There's the Greek part, and then on the east you have Anatolia, which is where you're going to get some of these other people groups. You're going to get the Mitanni. You're going to get the Hurrians. And a lot of scholars, and I think there's good evidence for this, we're going to go through some of it today, think that the Horites were the Hurrians. You know, you've got people coming from the Caucasus, from Turkey, what is now Turkey, down into the land. And their history is directly traceable back to Babylon. So the ancient person is going to sort of know, again, the ancient writer anyway, somebody who's literate, is going to know basically the bloodlines, the genealogies, the history of these peoples. And all that the biblical writers are going to need to know is that, look, we have here vestiges of certain places in Mesopotamia, specifically Babylon, that's the big one, who, again, are going to be perceived as generational offspring, you know, agents of chaos. They're going to emerge again from in Babylon's case, the Apkallu incident in the Era epic. This is how these people groups are going to be perceived. So some of them are going to come across the Mediterranean. They're going to settle in Canaan, even before, you know, we have the descendants of Esau, even before we have Moses and Joshua, and the descendants of Esau are going to wipe some of them out. Abraham, again, that whole incident in Genesis 14, they're going to be involved in that. And then, of course, here with Moses and Joshua. So there's a history here of certain people groups getting into Canaan that God is going to providentially deal with. And they have a long Mesopotamian history that goes all the way back to Babylon. That's what I want to try to, you know, sort of flesh out and explain in the time we have left for this episode. So the Avim, in a nutshell, are pre-Philistine sea people. And when I say pre-Philistines, I'm talking about the Philistines we know from the Bible that have settled, you know, in these cities. The Avim are going to have lived there before. They're going to come from the same areas as the Philistines are ultimately going to come from, but they're going to be conquered by the Philistines, and they're going to just be eliminated and absorbed. So there are pre-Philistine sea people, and Bowling, in his Anchor Bible Yale commentary, when he's commenting on Joshua 3, puts it this way. They were settled in the neighborhood of Gaza only to be at last attacked and displaced by people from Kaphtor, which is Crete. That is, again, the Philistines, unquote. He adds, interestingly enough, that the Septuagint, where we have Avim in these two passages, the Joshua passage, and then the one here in Deuteronomy, the Septuagint translates that as huio, which the Septuagint translator also uses to render Hivites. And the Hivites, again, are one of these people groups in the conquest that, again, are almost, we know almost nothing about. So there's a chance that they could have been the same, or at least perceived as the same. That's from Bowling's commentary in the Anchor Bible series. So what we glean from all this is that it would be odd to have the Horites thrown into this mix, where by the time Joshua at least gets written, these places are going to be characterized, known for giant clans. So it would be odd to have the Horites and, frankly, the Avim thrown into that mix if they weren't also, because they're described as being targeted in some cases by the same descendants, you know, from Abraham, the line of Esau, or others. Now, why would you throw them in there? Why would you even mention them if they weren't part of the same problem, if they weren't, you know, part of the same sort of targeted group, you know, that the biblical writers want us to realize that, hey, you know, God was basically getting rid of these vestiges of the days of chaos, the days of primeval chaos, you know, the descendants of the, if you're a Mesopotamian, the Apkallu, or descendants of the Nephilim. You know, God was already at work getting rid of those individuals. They were the biggest threat, even before Israel got there. And so why, if you're trying to make that point and you throw the Horites in, you know, it stands to reason that, okay, we've got something going on here with the Horites. Now, the Horites themselves, we know from the Bible that, you know, they preceded the Edomites and Seir. You know, we know their lineage and all that stuff. T. Gay writes, it is uncertain whether they are connected with the Horians, a non-Semitic people spread through the Near East in the 3rd and 2nd millennia B.C. And he's right. It's not certain, but a good case can be made for that. So I'm going to follow that trajectory. The possible link to the Hurrians is better addressed in conjunction with Genesis 14. And I'm not going to go too far into Genesis 14 here because a lot of this material is going to be, I'm going to do a presentation at a conference in Lubbock very shortly now, in the middle of August. And this is going to be my topic, so I don't want to tip too much of my hand there. So I want people to come to that. It's Jed Burton's conference, but I'm going to read this and we'll say a few things about it. Genesis 14, 5 through 7, if we read, again, that passage, here's what we get. This is that, you know, confederation of kings in Abraham's day. It says this. I'll go back to verse. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Amim in Shaveh-Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazon Tamar. You know, Amalekite there is something of an anachronism. Again, you have to realize Genesis 14 is written after the time of, you know, Esau, and, you know, it's going to be one of his sons whose concubine is actually the mother of Amalek. So the Amalekites there is a bit of an anachronism. And we've encountered this thing before in Exodus. You get it, you know, lots of places in the Old Testament because of the time of when something is written. But look at the names here. I mean, it's very obvious, you know, what you have going on here. You've got the Rephaim mentioned, the Zuzim, the Amim, the Amorites, which is the name used in the book of Amos for the giant clans generally, Amos 2, 9, and 10. The Amalekites, again, who descend from the Horites. And then, of course, you get the Horites thrown in here. Again, why would you put the Horites in here when everything else, you know, why would you put the Horites in there and then their descendant, Amalek, in this list? Unless you have the same kind of problem. There's just no reason to do it, because everything else in the list, again, is very explicitly associated with the giants, okay, giant clan stuff. So, again, this is what we're dealing with here. Now, let's go to Mesopotamian sources. You know, we don't want to lose sight. The Amalekites are derivative of the Horites. The Horites are likely, again, Tegay says it's uncertain, but again, you can make a good case for this. They're likely to be associated with a people called the Horians. And the Horians have some relationship association with the Amorites, at least in Mesopotamian sources. So what I want to do here is talk about other sources. Mesopotamian stuff. They know these people, and these people have a history. And what I'm going to point out here is that the names of these of individual people groups here are going to be used by biblical writers intentionally to take the mind of the reader back to the chaos of Babylon. What we get in the Bible is Horites and Hittites is another one of these. Some of these, even Philistines, some of the Genesis passages, but some of these names don't refer ethnically to people. They've sort of become swear words or bad words, bad labels that you would stick on people that you are afraid of or that you just don't like. Bad guys. And that is the way the biblical writers will use terms like Amorite, okay, even Canaanite, Horite, Amalekite, you know. But especially the Amorites and the Horites here, because they have a long history. If the Horites are Hurrians, there's a history here in Mesopotamian sources that explain why, you know, sort of give you some of the background as to why these names would be associated with Babylon itself. So to summarize what the primary sources of Mesopotamia show, here's just a bullet point list. Before the biblical patriarchs, before their time, in northwest Syria or Lebanon, that's the area geographically just north of Canaan, and in northwest Mesopotamia, if you think of the Tigris and Euphrates, those rivers extend almost, you know, into Syria. So, and again, that's just above, you know, Canaan, before the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in these areas, northwest Syria, Lebanon, northwest Mesopotamia, those places were occupied by a people known in Mesopotamian sources as Amorites. Now, these Amorites migrated east into Mesopotamia at some point before the third dynasty of Ur, which is still before the time of Abraham. They were therefore called by the Mesopotamians, the native Mesopotamian population. They were called Amoru. That's where Amorite comes from. And that means Westerner. Okay, people that come from the West. The Sumerian equivalent is Martu. Amoru, Martu, it's the same thing, just different languages. These Amorites eventually take control of Mesopotamia. They literally just run through Mesopotamia, the city-states there, including Babylon. What we don't realize is that Hammurabi, the great Hammurabi, was an Amorite. Okay, his dynasty was an Amorite dynasty. The Amorites took over Babylon. So what the biblical writers thought of as Babylonian then was historically Amorite. Okay, that's an important point to keep, you know, back in the back of your mind. When the biblical writers are talking about the Babylonians, yeah, it's people that live in Babylon. Okay, we get that. But the people who are in control in certain periods of time are actually these Amorites. So Amorite and Babylonian, in some contexts, they're almost synonymous. Again, like Hammurabi would be the best example. His dynasty was the Amorite dynasty. And the Amorites ruled most of the city-states in Mesopotamia. Now, when you get to around 1500 BC, which might be, again, the early date of the Exodus, again, right around there, there was another migration that occurred from the north. Another group, the Mitanni, which was a federation of Hurrian states. The Hurrians are another people group. They sweep down from Anatolia, so from part of the region that would have been associated with sea people. They sweep down from Anatolia through Syria. Some of them settle in Canaan. That was pretty minimal. They're going to, again, do the same thing the Amorites did. They're going to go through Mesopotamia. And they get all the way to Babylon. They actually, you know, conquer Babylon. But then they, for some reason, they turn around. And they go home. So they don't stay there. But what's left is a sort of a combination of still native Babylonians, Amorites, and now you've got some Hurrians or Horites in the same area. We're going to focus on Babylon. It's more than Babylon, but Babylon's the big deal here. So here we have all three of these terms, Horite, Amorite, Babylonian. You could even throw Hittite in here because from Anatolia, that's where the Hittite Empire was. So you get some Hittite presence there. These names, again, I think you can already see where this is going, are names that show up in the conquest accounts, you know, biblically, for not only people who, you know, need to be defeated, but several of them are associated with the giant clans. And that shouldn't be a surprise because Genesis 6, 1 through 4, the context for that, those four verses, really the first, you know, really five verses, if you want to be honest here, the context for that whole episode is the Apkallu story from Mesopotamia, which is focused on Marduk. You know, Marduk's reaction. Marduk is the one who punishes the Apkallu and all that kind of, which is Babylon. I mean, again, you have this matrix of ideas associated with individuals, again, the descendants of the Apkallu, which were half divine, half human, and they were giants, you know, Gilgamesh, all this kind of stuff. You're basically throwing all this into the hopper, and along with these place names. And for an Israelite, for a biblical writer, these are the worst of times and the worst of people. What happens here with the Apkallu to a Mesopotamian, they're heroes because they save, you know, they restore, you know, civilization after the flood. And Babylon's so wonderful, and we owe this to the Apkallu, you know, our divine overlords or whatever, you know, people that helped the kings and gave them wisdom and all this kind of stuff. Okay. But if you're a biblical writer, especially if you're writing Genesis 1 through 11, either editing it heavily or composing it during the exile in Babylon, okay, these are the worst of people and the worst of times. This is chaos central. This is anti-Eden. the conditions that emerge from this incident, the flood incident, with the sons of God, again, the Apkallu and the Mesopotamian story. Again, that is the worst of the worst. They are the very manifestation of the anti-Eden world. So this is how a biblical person, a biblical writer, is going to think about that. And when they're thinking about Babylon as anti-Eden, if they know the history of the place, they're also going to lump in the Hurrians, the Horites, the Amorites, again, all these other terms. And so when they write, again, about the conquest, they're going to be using these terms to label people that just generally oppose Yahweh and oppose the re-implantation of Eden. In other words, the kingdom of God, Yahweh's people in his land and his temple, you know, all that stuff. They're going to be standing in the way. And if they happen to be unusually tall, they're the worst of the worst. They're the biggest threat. They are the personifications of anti-Eden. And this is how this set of circumstances is parsed in the mind of the biblical writer. So when we encounter these terms in the Old Testament, again, we shouldn't be surprised if we know a little of the history. Where else do we learn about Eden in the Old Testament? Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. You go back and read that stuff, ask yourself the question, are there Babylonian elements in those episodes too, in those diatribes against the king? Well, good grief, Isaiah, king of Babylon, and he's the one that it's directed at. And again, using the story of divine rebellion, again, I hope, listeners have read Unseen Realm, because I can't rehearse the content of Unseen Realm in every episode, or even any episode. But this diatribe against the king of Babylon is using the story of a supernatural rebellion, you know, in the heavens, in the council, to comment on or go after the hubris of the king of Babylon. But it's Babylon again. Okay, it's this rebellion motif, which again, if you're familiar with the Genesis 6 story, you get that. If you know, you go back, you know, to what happens in Eden, rebellion of one particular divine being, a member of Yahweh's council, to eliminate, you know, the humans that he doesn't want. You know, there you are again. Again, there are Babylonish elements to all of the stories in Genesis 1 through 11. That is not an accident. You're supposed to be thinking anti-Eden in all these stories. And not only anti-Eden in terms of people, what people do to screw up, but supernatural agents who are in rebellion against the true God and who not only are adversarial in their relationship to him, but they are adversarial in their relationship to his human family. This is what all this stuff is about on a cosmic geographical level. Ezekiel 28, you know, cherubim, I mean, you get the Mesopotamian, the Babylonish elements there. And Ezekiel's writing from where? Babylon. Okay. Again, all of these things are factors in the way writers are writing things and the way their readers are deciphering what's being written. So when you come across Babylonish stuff and some of these other, again, people group names and even the place names, you should be thinking that the thing that should pop into your head from this point forward, hopefully, is anti-Eden. That is an agent of Eden, you know, an agent against Eden. He's a representative of anti-Eden chaos. Because that's what an Israelite's going to be thinking. That's how they're going to be parsing these things. You know, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, they're not lessons on, you know, heavenly zoology. Okay, like you know, I've run into people all the time. Well, explain the anatomy of the cherub. If you're going down those rabbit trails, you're missing the point. These are metaphors, okay? They are descriptions, images, iconographic descriptions, okay, of agents that the biblical person would have immediately associated with Babylon and anti-Eden. That is how you're supposed to be thinking about these passages, not getting a heavenly zoology lesson. And it's the same thing for, you know, some of the terminology here associated with people groups. It's not a geography lesson. These terms are being used to conjure, you know, to produce certain ideas, thought patterns in the reader's head. And the main thought pattern is chaos, anti-Eden, enemy of Eden. And specifically, some of those enemies that come from the Nephilim, the Apkallu and the Mesopotamian side. You know, the worst of the worst. And this is how, again, the writers are trying to get their readers to think. Now, a few notes on the term Amorite. Again, this is from Anchor Bible Dictionary. The term Amuru first occurs in old Akkadian sources as the general designation of the West, referring to the west wind and to the geographical area lying to the northwest of Mesopotamia. The most frequent usage of the term refers to the population of that western region as an ethnic designation. Then in those days, its semantic equivalent, Sumerian Mar II, was used already in the 3rd millennium BC, even at Ebla, in an ethnic or cultural sense, designating the population of the West. Okay, that was recognized to be foreign. These are foreigners. To the Mesopotamians, the Amorites were foreigners, you know, that are going to invade their own lands. It's going to be bad, but they're going to become the Babylonians, okay, that the biblical writers know. Amorite is not a Semitic language, okay? Well, let me be more precise. It can't be established as a Semitic language. It's something different. Akkadian is Semitic. It's East Semitic. Sumerian, of course, is something different. Amorite is different than that. It's not related to Hebrew or Ugaritic. It's not part of the Northwest Semitic group. They were their own people. They're foreigners, okay? And again, recent studies of Amorite, you know, have established this. For those of you who are interested in this sort of thing, Journal of Semitic Studies actually just came out with an article, Alexander Andresen and Juan Pablo Vida, Amorite, a Northwest Semitic Language? And they basically conclude that, you know, we really can't say that it's Semitic. It has features of Semitic, but there's lots of stuff that is just totally different. So I mention this not, you know, for some language lesson, but these are outsiders. They're foreigners. Now, what we know of them, though, Amorite has produced, at least to date, no texts. There are no Amorite texts, like literary texts or even economic texts. What we do have are, oh, I don't know, the neighborhood of 6,000 or so personal names that are Amorite. You're familiar with biblical names, how you can sort of take them apart and they say something. Biblical names have a grammar, okay? Daniel, Daniel, God is my judge, okay? It's actually a verbalist clause, okay? Amorite is the same way, you know, and other names in other languages too. And we have about 6,000 of these, and they come from all parts of Mesopotamia. So it's demonstrable that the Amorites, both by the evidence of personal names and what the Mesopotamians actually say later on, took over the whole area. I mean, this is an invasion. You know, and it was viewed, you know, negatively by the people of the time, but they become what the biblical writers know as Babylon. You get the same thing, as I mentioned before, with the Mitanni, the Hurrians. Mitanni is a kind of an empire name, but it's actually a confederation of Hurrian city-states. From North Mesopotamia, again, they do the same thing, just like I described a few minutes ago. So this is what you have, you know, happening. You have all of these people sweeping down, you know, invading what would become biblical Babylon. And the names of these people sort of become part of a metaphorical vocabulary to take the mind of the biblical reader back to this place, specifically to Babylon. That's ground zero for the anti-Eden. And when you do that, and you're talking about giants, you as an Israelite, again, a literate Israelite, are going to think, oh yeah, I know why Genesis 6:1-4 is there. You know, the Mesopotamians thought these were great. This was great after the flood, you know, that the sons of God, you know, the divine beings, the Apkallu, came and, you know, had children that were hybrids and all this kind of stuff. And they thought that was great. It saved their civilization. But we know, again, this led to disaster, depravity, idolatry, people forsaking the true God and worshiping these other beings as gods and so on and so forth. I mean, this is where the writer wants to take the mind of the reader. Because an Israelite, let's face it, again, this is what we do here at Naked Bible. I've made the comment a number of times. You run across these weird passages, weird people groups, weird names. The Israelite who's living, you know, in the first millennium BC or even the early second millennium BC, they're going to know just what to do with this stuff. They're going to know. They're going to know what it means. They're going to know sort of where to plug it in their worldview and their theology. They're just going to know because it's part of their world. We don't know any of it. So we have to go back and try to recover it. And so, again, to us, it's difficult. It's work. But, you know, that's what we try to do here. I want to read one other selection here. I go back to Anchor Bible Dictionary. Amorite as a political designation. ABD says, it was noted above that in native Amorite society, there were already kings and other titles that designated political functions or offices. So let me just stop there. When the Amorites come in there, they take over. They set up their own governmental political systems. Again, Hammurabi, his dynasty was Amorite. And they're going to use certain terms to describe themselves as rulers and their apparatus, their bureaucracy. Again, it's normal stuff. So ABD continues, following the diaspora of the Amorites in the 20th to 19th centuries BC, there was evidently a multitude of political titles that made use of the term Amuru or the Sumerian Martu. The term father of the land of Amuru was used at Larsa, for example, by an Elamite king, and subsequently by other kings, including Hammurabi. The title became King of the Amorites by Hammurabi's 35th year, and was a standard appellative of kings from then on, obviously devoid of any ethnic connotations. Now, that's an important paragraph. What it means is, after the Amorites invade and they take over and they set up office, the title King of the Amorites is going to be used across the board in Mesopotamia and in the years following by anyone who's a king, whether they're ethnically an Amorite or not, because they sort of want to hitch their wagon to the conquerors. All right, it just becomes a title, King of the Amorites. Now, that becomes an issue when we get into biblical stuff. Back to ABD. The next and last occurrence of the royal title King of the Amorites occurs in the biblical references to Sihon, S-I-H-O-N, who associated with Heshbon in Transjordan and who was defeated in the earliest recorded battle of the newly established Israelite Federation, Numbers 21. There can be little doubt of the historicity of the event, even though the present narratives are, of course, garbled by the overlay of later tradition and interpretation. His royal title must have derived from and represented a continuation of the political traditions of the old North Syrian principality of Amuru, the Amorites. Together with a number of other puzzling traditions, notably the Balaam narratives, this title strongly indicates a considerable influx of population into Transjordan. Again, Transjordan is the other side of the Jordan. And into Palestine at the time when destructions in North Syria were leaving much of that region virtually depopulated. At the same time, in the transition from the late Bronze to the early Iron Age, the population of Transjordan saw a very sharp rise in density. And the only reasonable source for this rapid growth was the region to the north. Even the name Sihon, as well as Og of Bashan, who is also identified as an Amorite king, has no reasonable Semitic etymology. As was true also in Mesopotamia, the term Amorite no longer had any ethnic or linguistic significance and had simply become part of the traditional titulary of kings with North Syrian cultural connections. By the way, it's the foe from the north thing working its way through again. Again, if you've read Unseen Realm, you know what that is. The conclusion is inescapable that Sion and others were the remnants of north political entities. They were the Amorites that invaded Babylon long before had come from. And they were attempting to reestablish their old political regimes in another region, the Transjordan. So, again, what that means is the Amorites go into Babylon, they take over. they're so ubiquitous in terms of their rulership that the title King of Amorites, King of the Amorites, becomes something everybody uses everywhere. Now, when they, again, have trouble, when they get run out of town by the Mitanni, by the Horians, they eventually are going to go down into the Transjordan, where we find them biblically. Let's just say circa 1500 BC, Sion, Og. Okay, and Og, again, clearly, you know, these are Rephaim. They're clearly associated with giant clan stuff, okay? They're going to come down into the Transjordan, and they're going to call themselves Amorite kings. Doesn't mean they're Amorite ethnically descended. Like, if you gave them a DNA tag, you're an Amorite. No. It means that they are trying to link their authority with the old Amorites with Babylon. Okay, it's Babylon again. This is why in Unseen Realm, I mean, I made a few comments on this in Unseen Realm, specifically about the way Og and his bed are described. Okay, if you remember this, again, if you've read the book, the sacred marriage bed of Marduk in Babylon aligns to the cubit, I mean, precisely with Og's bed, the dimensions that are given in Deuteronomy 3. Now, I'm going to read a little excerpt from Unseen Realm. The most immediate link back to the Babylonian polemic is Og's bed. In Hebrew, it's the Eres. Its dimensions, 9 by 4 cubits, are precisely those of the cultic bed in the ziggurat called Etemen Anki, which is the ziggurat most archaeologists identify as the Tower of Babel referred to in the Bible. Ziggurats function as temples and divine abodes. The unusually large bed at Etemen Anki was housed in the, quote, the house of the bed, the Beit Ershi. Ershi and Eres, in Hebrew, the word used for Og's bed, those are cognate equivalents. It was the place where the god Marduk and his divine wife, Zarpanitu, met annually for ritual lovemaking, the purpose of which was divine blessing upon the land. Unquote. Then in a footnote, I add this. Consequently, in addition to the giantism element, a link between Og and Marduk via the matching bed dimensions may also have telegraphed the idea that Og was the inheritor and perpetuator of the Babylonian knowledge and cosmic order from before the flood. Again, and that, let me stop there. That's what Og wants you to think. That's why Og is calling himself an Amorite king. Okay, I'm from Babylon. I inherited the civilization. I mean, I'm a product of the wonderful Apkallu salvation that resulted in the greatness of Babylon. That's what Og wants you to think. You know, and again, the biblical writers are clued into this. This is what the dimensions of Og's bed are about, not telling us how tall Og was precisely, but to link Og back to anti-Eden. And that's what the term Amorite is supposed to do. That's what the term Horite is supposed to do in these narratives, in these conquest narratives. Now, ABD continues, that Sion and Og were not the only illustrations of such a process is indicated by the fact that the Amorites are also included in all of the various tables of the nations scattered through the Pentateuch and Joshua. These lists designate political regimes and not merely ethnic groups. This is evident both from the fact that they are labeled Goyim, which is probably best defined as a politically organized military gang, just a group of people, maybe mercenaries, something like that. Again, a military force, a state force. They're labeled Goyim, and from the fact that some of them, such as the Jebusites of Jerusalem, there's another name that we get associated with the conquest, okay? The Jebusites of Jerusalem can definitely be identified with specific city-states. It has been established that the regime of Jerusalem, already in the Amarna period, okay, this just call it 1300 BC, this is long before David. David has to take Jerusalem from the Jebusites, okay? It has long been established that the regime of Jerusalem, already in the Amarna period, derived from North Syria. That's where the Amorites are from. Its Amorite derivation is indicated not only by its name, Yavus, which is Amorite Yabusum, but also by the bitter condemnation of the prophet Ezekiel, Ezekiel 16:2-3, who accurately described Jerusalem's origin as a hybrid of Amorite and Hittite. Remember what the verses said? Ezekiel 16, Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations and say, thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth are of the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. And both those terms, Amorite, Hittite, are from the Amorite and the Mitannian invasions that will create what the biblical writers know as Babylon. Again, these things are not accident. And isn't that cool? When David, the prototype of the Messiah, chooses a capital, it's Jebus, Jebus, the Amorite capital. Okay, it's like he's invading the new Babylon and taking it for Yahweh. You know, again, the conceptual imagery here, if you know the backloaded story and why these terms are used, why these place names, why these people group terms are used, it is all about the supernatural rebellions of Genesis 1 through 11. It's all about that, the anti-Eden, all of it. Again, what we do typically is we think that the context for understanding this stuff is just a map or pieces of pottery, you know, or you know, historical records of this or that. And all that's important. It is. But what you get typically with biblical scholars today is that they never even think about or introduce to you the cosmic religious angle of all of this stuff. That's what's missing. That's why the Old Testament can be pretty dry and toasty. You know, this is a conflict between two kingdoms. You know, I've used that phrase of Jesus' announcement about the kingdom of God. What is spiritual warfare? Spiritual warfare is actually the conflict between two kingdoms. And it's easy to see that when Jesus shows up and he starts saying things like, the kingdom of God is among you. You know, and he starts casting out demons. Yeah, spiritual warfare. We finally get some of that. Look, you've been having that for a long time. You just don't recognize it because we don't know the terminology. We don't know the worldview in our heads. What Jesus is doing with Satan, casting out the demonic presence, okay, in various places, and he hits both Jewish and Gentile territory, okay? When he's doing this, he's doing what the Israelites were doing to the giant clans. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the conflict of two kingdoms. It's the effort to reinstall Eden and defeat the anti-Eden. It's order against chaos. It's Yahweh against the gods. It's Yahweh's children against their children. This is how it's perceived. But again, most of the time, Old Testament, you know, scholars, even in the evangelical tradition, they don't want to go there. It's just too weird, you know. Well, okay, call it weird. It's weird. That's good. That's a nice word. But it's what's in the head of a biblical writer. Do you want to understand what they're writing or not? You know, here we go again. It's the same thing. I'll quote you a little bit from Peoples of the Old Testament World. This is a good book. I recommend it. I think it's available in paperback now. Numbers 13:29 states, quote, the Amalekites live in the land of the Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live by the sea and along the Jordan. While the Amorites are here listed among the peoples of the land, the Bible provides scant evidence about them. Yeah, specifically ethnically. The word Amorite, it continues, has ancient origins, deriving from the Akkadian Amoru, the equivalent of the earlier Sumerian Martu. In both languages, the word could designate a region, people, or direction, Westerner. You know, and then it goes on to again talk about, you know, the Amorites, but it says here, the discernment of specific ethnic groups from archaeological evidence is next to impossible. Excavations from Hazor in the north to Lachish in the south clearly indicate that throughout the region during the period of the Middle and Late Bronze Ages, the material culture was uniform. In the absence of inscriptional material, it's impossible to determine the relationship of particular material remains to a specific group. Nevertheless, Kathleen Kenyon begins with the biblical statement that the Amorites live in the hill country. The Canaanites live by the sea along the Jordan, Numbers 13:29. You know, and then, you know, the rest of it is where these people live. Amorites are the hill dwellers, Canaanites are the plain dwellers, so on and so forth. I'm going to be as gentle as possible here. It doesn't matter because Amorite transcends ethnicity. The term transcends ethnicity. And that's what you get with Horites, Horite Hurrian. Horites maybe are also the Hivites. Okay. You're dealing with the use of a term to label a people an enemy who themselves, like Sion and Og, I mean, they wanted to be thought of as Amorites. They want you to think that they're the vestiges of what happened long ago in Babylon. Okay. It's supposed to make you think of that. It provides a cosmic theological rationale for what's happening on the ground in terms of the conquest in this area. And Yahweh has decided to settle, you know, early before they even get to the land. Yahweh is here in this region. This is where his mountain is. And he's going to clean house. He doesn't want any agents of chaos, any, again, of these descendants from the days of the flood, okay, the violation of the flood. He doesn't want them in his house, in his home, in his backyard, in his front yard. He doesn't want them. So he's going to remove them in preparation for the company that he does want. That would be his people who he has taken out of Egypt. And then when they're there, he's going to give them the law, and then he's going to travel with them to Canaan. And we're going to have to repeat the process where we go. We're going to go to the Transjordan and finish the job there, because we still have some of these Amorite dudes left. The Rephaim are still up there in Bashan. So we're going to take care of business there. The descendants of Esau have already taken care of business in Ammon and Moab. Okay? We're going to take care of business in Bashan, and then we're going to cross into the land. And these are the targets. The people, those individuals that are perceived as being descended from the episode of the flood. This is where you get, again, you know, the whole failure, you know, Numbers 13, you know, again, like I talk about an unseen realm, it's not a coincidence that where the verbs of killing, the cherem terminology and other verbs are used, if you go to the places where they're used, they all happen to be places where the Anakim were spotted. I mean, again, it's not a coincidence. It's again, it's a theological, cosmic theological rationale for what is going on and what God wants done. There are other verbs of conquest used. Again, I point this out in Unseen Realm that talk about dispossess, drive out, expel. It's not just verbs of killing. Again, it's the verbs of killing show up when you have armed conflict in places where the vestiges of the giant clans are. You just do. And again, I'm not saying that other people aren't killed. And these particular individuals are scattered throughout the land. They're pockets of them. They live in different places among, you know, the other peoples of the land. Okay, but they're the ones that get targeted, and God has been targeting them long, you know, for centuries before Israel ever shows up. And this is the overarching rationale for what's going on here. Now let's take this back to, again, just spend a few minutes here in Exodus. I told you it was going to be like a long rabbit trail to set this up. So Exodus 17, 8 through 16, the battle with the Amalekites. Again, we know where this place is. It's part of this regional complex where Yahweh is, and Sinai and the mountain and all this sort of stuff. So we know, you know, kind of the context here for what's going on. And let's just read a couple of the, there are a few things here that are kind of curious when we actually get into it. Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men, go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." And that's an important phrase. He's going to stand on the hill with the staff of God in his hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. And then in verses 12 and following, they give him a place to sit. They hold up his hands on either side. And when the hands are up, Israel prevails. When they're down, Amalek prevails. So, you know, what's going on here? Well, in episode 280, the one on Aliens, 12 springs, and 70 palm trees. You know, the latter, the end of Exodus 15. We talked a little bit about this. The rod is conceptually connected to the tree metaphor of divine presence. Okay, where did he get the rod? Burning bush. Okay, God specifically, you know, empowers Moses through the rod. You know, take your rod that's in your hand, put it down, you know, and all these things that Moses is going to now use the rod to work for signs. It represents the power of God and the presence of God because of where it came from and because God is with Moses. It also goes back even further. You know, as we talked in episode 280, you know, again, you got to think like an ancient person, but where do rods come from? They come from trees. They're made of wood. Why are trees important? Because they mark places of divine encounter. This is all over the Old Testament, okay? They mark, especially, you know, the Torah, they mark places of divine encounter. And the big one, of course, is Eden. You know, it sets kind of a different tone because here we have Moses with the rod of God in his hand, which again serves as a cosmic metaphor for the presence and power of God. And where was the presence and power of God first known on earth? Well, that would be Eden. Okay, the garden. Gardens have trees. Okay, again, all of these things are interrelated. The set of ideas, a matrix of ideas here. So you have, again, it's cosmic geography. It's holy war in that sense. God is going to deal with Amalek, who is descended from the Horites, in this place with the tree, okay, with the rod, okay. Again, it conceptually the elements just come together, and it just gives you a little bit of a different flavoring for what's going on in the confrontation. You know, the battle, you have the rod of God used. You get to verse 11. You know, the part about holding up the hands. You know, commentators will say, well, you know, the meaning of the holding up the hands is unclear. Maybe it's like laying on a pan. No, he has the rod in his hands. That's what the earlier verse said. He's not going to stand up there with empty hands and, you know, raise the hands and look. No, I'm going to stand at the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. That's what the hands are. The motion is about raising the rod. And that language, interestingly enough, you know, if we actually look up the lemma used here for held up, okay, that also occurs, the same verb about holding up the staff of God and holding up the hands. It occurs in Exodus 7:20. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded. In the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, he lifted up the staff and struck the water in the Nile. And all the water in the Nile turned into blood. It shows up in Exodus 14:16. Lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. To me, it's very clear, you know, that what's going on here, he is wielding the rod of God. Moses is empowered by the rod, the staff. And why is it important that it be held up? So that the people can see who is delivering them, who is giving them victory. You hold it up at the top of the hill. If you're not holding it up, they don't know that it's there. They don't know that Yahweh is fighting on their behalf. Again, the victory is linked to the rod. It's not Moses. It's not Joshua's generalship. It's the rod of God. It's the staff. And it's seen when you hold it up high. Again, that's the whole point of the description of the story. Now, verses 15 and 16 to wrap up, they're kind of enigmatic. You know, Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Now, that's the ESV. Sarna says, although the passage purports to be an explanation of the altar's name, the relationship between the two, between the altar and the saying, okay, are difficult to discern. Well, they are, you know. Currid, in his commentary, writes this, and I think this is you'll see what I think here in a minute. Currid writes, the Hebrew term often translated banner is really standard or signal pole. The Hebrew word is nes, N-E-S. Okay. In antiquity, a standard was a rallying point. Often it bore an emblem, symbol, or banner on its top. A standard was normally raised on a hill or other high place to be seen by all. It was an object of focus and hope for the people. And so Moses' appearance on the top of the hill with the rod of God in his hand acted much like a standard. The rod on the hill served as a symbol of Yahweh's power. Yahweh was thus seen to be the standard beneath which Israel rallied. Now, we know that the word banner is nes. Okay, so let me go back to the two verses again. Here, you know, it sounds kind of odd. Okay, Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner. The Lord is my nes." Okay, nesi, actually in Hebrew. Saying, Moses is like interpreting the name of the altar. Hand upon the throne of the Lord. What's that? What throne? What are we talking about here? Now, a lot of commentators have pointed out that the word throne here is case, kaf, instead of nun, spelled, you know, the consonants between nase and case are the same except the first one. And so some have thought, well, maybe this is a script error. It's true that old Hebrew, Paleo Hebrew letters K and N are very similar. And so when the Hebrew Bible was moved or transcribed, either from old Hebrew or when the script being used was transitioning from the old Hebrew script to the block script that we're familiar with today, they could have confused the K and the N. And so maybe we're supposed to read banner in both these verses. The Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the banner of the Lord. That would make sense in view of Moses holding up the rod and stuff like that. So most commentators are going to say, look, this is a text critical problem. It should read a hand upon the banner of the Lord, not a hand upon the throne of the Lord, which really doesn't make any sense. And the point would be, if we make that textual change, the point of calling the altar, the Lord is my banner, Yahweh is my, it would be Yahweh is my power. Yahweh fights for me. And then the following verse, changing throne to banner, would be to explain how the Lord fought. Well, he wielded his rod against his enemies. The altar would mark the ground as under Yahweh's dominion. So it kind of works, it kind of fits. And to me, that's a good explanation. However, the Masoretic text, as it stands, could be kept. You don't have to make the change. You can still sort of get the same basic point. Instead of a hand upon the throne of Yahweh, you could translate the verse, a hand against the throne of Yahweh. And what would the point there be if we just go with the word throne? Hand against. Well, the reading as it stands would explain not how the Lord fought, because it doesn't have the word banner in it anymore. It has the word throne. It would instead explain why the Lord fought. The Amalekites had encroached on his domain, his sovereignty, there at Rephidim, which again is in the region of all these other places associated with the presence of God in Sinai. So the Amalekites are trespassers, and they're also threatening God's people. So if we say, if Moses builds the altar and calls the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying there was a hand against the throne of Yahweh here, and the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation because of that. Anti-Eden is encroaching upon Eden. That would be the point. So whichever one you prefer, again, I think you can make a good, you know, very interesting theological, you know, cosmic theological statement out of it. So that's the latter half of Exodus 17. Again, you know, I told you up front, it's going to sound like a long rabbit trail, but I think it's useful to do this from time to time because there's just a lot going on under the surface if you think like an Israelite. Again, a literate Israelite who knows the set of ideas, who knows the little bit of the history of the other people, and the scribes. I mean, these are literate people writing the Hebrew Bible for their own audience, and they're assuming certain points of knowledge about peoples and about terms and about places in their own lives, in their own histories, whether they be oral histories or some other parts of the Bible that happened to be written before this, whatever, that we just lack. We just lack exposure to that sort of thing. So I think it's useful to go on rabbit trails like this occasionally, because they become helpful for kind of fleshing out things that are going on in a particular passage.
All right, Mike, I enjoy rabbit trails. They are fun. What do we got
for Exodus 18? Again, since we dealt with Exodus 18 in actually a couple earlier episodes, and I'm going to reference those when we get there so people can go listen to them. So since we did that, I'm going to spend Exodus 18 talking about the institution of elders in Israel. You know, who were they? There's actually different groups of elders, the same term used, but who were these guys? What did they do? What was their role? So on and so forth. So basically an episode on Israelite eldership.
All right. Looking forward to that. All right, Mike. Well, we'll get everybody out with that. I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.